said Mother. You must have been at least a little bit cute. Oh, don't splash the beans like that or we'll end up eating dinner off the walls. Papa makes bean mash better than you do, said Deco. How kind of you to say so, said Mother. But when you go to work, you're Papa's boss. Mother sighed. Your father and I work together. You're head of the project, everybody says so. Yes, that's true. If you're the head, is Papa the elbow or what? Papa is the hands and feet, the eyes and heart. Deco started to giggle. Are you sure Papa isn't the stomach? I think your father's little pot belly is sweet. Well, it's a good thing Papa isn't the bottom of the project. That's enough, Deco, said Mother. Have a little respect. You really are not young enough anymore for that sort of thing to be cute.
If it's not cute, what is it?
Nasty.
I'm going to be nasty my whole life, said Deco defiantly.
I have no doubt of it, said Mother.
I'm going to stop Cristoforo, she said.
Mother looked at her oddly. That's my job, if it can be done at all.
You'll be too old, said Deco. I'm going to grow up and stop him for you.
Mother didn't argue. By the time Deco was 10, she spent all her afternoons in the lab, learning to use the old tempo view. Technically, she wasn't supposed to use it, but the whole installation at Eilerit was now devoted to Mother's project, and so it was Mother's attitudes towards the rules that prevailed. This meant that everyone followed scientific procedures rigorously, but the boundary line between work and home wasn't very carefully observed. Children and relatives were often about, and as long as they were quiet, no one worried. It wasn't as if anything secret were going on. Besides, nobody was using the outdated tempo views except to replay old recordings, so Deco wasn't interfering with anybody's work. Everyone knew that Deco was careful, so no one even commented on the fact that an unauthorized, half-educated child was browsing through the past unsupervised. At first, Father rigged the tempo view that Deco used so that it would only replay previously recorded views. Deco soon became annoyed with this, however, because the tempo view had such a restricted perspective. She always longed to see things from another angle. Just before her 12th birthday, she figured out how to bypass Father's cursory attempt at blocking her from full access. She wasn't particularly deft about it. Father's computer must have told him what she had done, and he came to see her almost within the hour. "So, you want to go looking into the past," he said.
"I don't like the views that other people recorded," she said. "They're never interested in what I'm interested in."
"What we're deciding right now," said Father, "is whether to banish you from the past entirely, or to give you the freedom that you want."
Deco felt suddenly ill. "Don't banish me," she said. "I'll stay with the old views, but don't make me leave."
"I know that all the people you look at are dead," said Father, "but that doesn't mean that it's right for you to spy on them just out of curiosity."
"Isn't that what Past Watch is all about?" asked Deco.
"No," said Father. "Curiosity, yes, but not personal curiosity. We're scientists."
"I'll be a scientist too," said Deco.
"We look at people's lives to find out why people do what they do."
"Me too," said Deco.
"You'll see terrible things," said Father. "Ugly things. Very private things. Disturbing things."
"I already have."
"That's what I mean," said Father. "If you thought the things we've allowed you to see up to now were ugly, private, or disturbing, what will you do when you see things that are really ugly, private, and disturbing?"
"Ugly, private, and disturbing. Sounds like a firm of solicitors," said Deco.
"If you're going to have the privileges of a scientist, then you have to act like a scientist," said Father.
"Meaning?"
"I want daily reports of what places and times you've watched. I want weekly reports of what you've been examining and what you've learned. You must maintain a log just like everybody else, and if you see something disturbing, talk to me or your mother."
Deco grinned. "Got it. Ugly and private I deal with myself, but disturbing I discuss with the ancient ones."
"You are the light of my life," said Father. but I think I didn't yell at you enough when you were young enough for it to do any good.
I'll turn in all the reports you asked for, she said, but you have to promise to read them.
On exactly the same basis as anybody else's reports, said Father, so you'd better not show me any second-rate work.
Deco explored, reported, and began to look forward to her weekly interviews with Father concerning the work she did. Only gradually did she realize how childish and elementary those early reports were, how she skimmed over the surface of issues resolved long before by adult watchers. She marveled that Father never gave her a clue that she wasn't on the cutting edge of science. He always listened with respect, and within a few years, Deco was doing things that merited it. It was old Cristoforo Colombo, of all people, who got her away from the tempo view and onto the far more sensitive true sight. She had never forgotten him because mother and father never forgot him, but her early explorations with the tempo view never involved him. Why should they? She had seen practically every moment of Colombo's life in the old recordings that mother and father had been looking at more or less continuously all her life. What brought her back to Colombo was the question she had set for herself. When do the great figures of history make the decisions that set them on the path of greatness? She eliminated from her study all the people who simply drifted into fame. It was the ones who struggled against great obstacles and never gave up who intrigued her. Some of them were monsters, and some were noble. Some were self-serving opportunists, and some were altruists. Some of their achievements crumbled almost at once, and some changed the world in ways that had reverberations down to the present. To Deco, that hardly mattered. She was searching for the moment of decision, and, after writing reports on several dozen great figures, it occurred to her that in all her watching of Cristoforo, she had never actually sat down and studied him in a linear way, seeing what caused this son of an ambitious Genovese weaver to take to the sea and tear up all the old maps of the world. That Cristoforo was one of the great ones could not be doubted, whether mother and father approved of him or not. So, when was the decision made? When did he first set foot on the course that made him one of the most famous men in history? She thought she found the answer in 1459, when the rivalry between the two great houses of Genova, the Fieschi and the Adorno, was coming to a head. In that year, a man named Domenico Colombo was a weaver, a supporter of the Fieschi party, the former keeper of the Olivella Gate, and the father of a little red-headed boy who had within him the power to change the world.
Cristoforo was 8 years old the last time Pietro Fregoso came to visit his father. Cristoforo knew the man's name, but he also knew that in Domenico Colombo's house, Pietro Fregoso was always called by the title that had been wrested from him by the Adorno party, the Doge. Pietro Fregoso had decided to make a serious play for power again, and since Cristoforo's father was one of the most fiery partisans in the Fieschi cause, it was not too surprising that Pietro chose to honor the Colombo house by holding a secret meeting there. Pietro arrived in the morning, accompanied by only a couple of men. He had to move inconspicuously through the city, or the Adornos would know he was plotting something. Cristoforo saw his father kneel and kiss Pietro's ring. Mother, who was standing in the doorway between the weaving shop and the front room, muttered something about the Pope under her breath. But Pietro was the Doge of Genova, or rather the former Doge. No one called him the Pope.
"What did you say, Mama?"
"Nothing," she said. "Come in here." Cristoforo found himself being dragged into the weaving shop where the journeyman's looms rocked and banged as the apprentices carried thread back and forth or crawled under the loom to fold the cloth that the journeymen were weaving. Cristoforo had a vague awareness that someday soon his father would expect him to take his place as an apprentice in the shop of some other member of the Weaver's Guild. He did not look forward to it. The life of the apprentice was one of drudgery and meaningless labor, and the journeyman's teasing turned into serious torment when father and mother were not in the room. In another weaver's shop, Cristoforo knew, he would not have the protected status he had here, where his father was master. Soon Mother lost interest in Cristoforo, and he was able to drift back to the doorway and watch the goings-on in the front room, where the bolts of cloth had been cleared from the display table and the great spools of thread pulled up like chairs. Several other men had drifted in during the past few minutes. It was to be a meeting, Cristoforo saw. Pietro Fregoso was holding a council of war and in Father's house. At first it was the great men that Cristoforo watched. They were dressed in the most dazzling, extravagant clothing he had ever seen. None of Father's customers came into the shop dressed like this, but some of their clothing was made from Father's finest cloth. Cristoforo recognized the rich brocade one gentleman was wearing as a cloth made not a month ago by Carlo, the best of the journeymen. It had been picked up by Tito, who always wore a green uniform. Only now did Cristoforo realize that when Tito came to buy, he was not buying for himself, but rather for his master. Tito was not a customer then. He merely did what he was sent to do, yet Father treated him like a friend, even though he was a servant. This got Cristoforo thinking about the way Father treated his friends. The joking, the easy affection, the shared wine, the stories. Eye to eye they spoke, Father and his friends. Father always said that his greatest friend was the Doge, was Pietro Fregoso. Yet now Cristoforo saw that this was not the truth. For Father did not joke, showed no easiness in his manner, told no stories, and the wine he poured was for the gentlemen at the table, and not for himself at all. Father hovered at the edges of the room, watching to see if any man needed more wine, pouring it immediately if he did. And Pietro did not include Father in his glance when he met the eyes of the men around the table. No, Pietro was not Father's friend. By all appearances, Father was Pietro's servant. It made Cristoforo feel a little sick inside, for he knew that Father took great pride in having Pietro for a friend. Cristoforo watched the meeting, seeing the graceful movements of the rich men, listening to the elegance of their language. Some of the words Cristoforo didn't even understand, and yet he knew the words were Genovese and not Latin or Greek. Of course Father has nothing to say to these men, Cristoforo thought. They speak another language. They're foreigners, as surely as the strange men Cristoforo saw down at the docks one day, the ones from Provence. How did these gentlemen learn to speak this way? Cristoforo wondered. How did they learn to say words that are never spoken in our house or on the street? How can such words belong to the language of Genova, and yet none of the common Genovese know them? Is this not one city? Are these men not of the Fieschi, as Father is? The Adorno braggarts who pushed over Fieschi carts in the market, Father spoke more like them than like these gentlemen who were supposedly of his own party. There is more difference between gentlemen and tradesmen like Father than there is between Adorno and Fieschi. Yet the Fieschi and the Adorno often came to blows, and there were stories of killings. Why were there no quarrels between tradesmen and gentlemen? Only once did Pietro Fregoso include Father in the conversation. "I'm impatient with all this biding our time, biding our time," he said. "Look at our Domenico here." He gestured toward Cristoforo's father, who stepped forward like a tavern keeper who had been called upon. 7 years ago, he was keeper of the Olivella Gate. Now he has a house half the size of the one he had then, and only 3 journeymen instead of the 6 from before. Why? Because the so-called Doge steers all the business to Adorno weavers, because I am out of power and I can't protect my friends.
It is not all a matter of Adorno patronage, my lord, said one of the gentlemen. The whole city is poorer. What with the Turk in Constantinople, the Muslims harrying us at Chios, and the Catalonian pirates who boldly raid our very docks and loot the houses near the water.
My point exactly, said the Doge. Foreigners put this puppet into power. What do they care how Genova suffers? It is time to restore true Genovese rule. I will not hear a contradiction."
One of the gentlemen spoke quietly into the silence that followed Pietro's speech.
"We are not ready," he said. "We will pay in precious blood for a foolhardy attack now."
Pietro Fregoso glowered at him.
"So, I say I will not hear a contradiction, and then you contradict me? What party are you in, De Portobello?"
"Yours to the death, my lord," said the man.
"But you were never one who punished a man for saying to you what he believed to be the truth."
"Nor will I punish you now," said Pietro, "as long as I can count on you standing beside me."
De Portobello rose to his feet. "In front of you, my lord, or behind you, or wherever I must stand to protect you when danger threatens." At that, Father stepped forward unbidden.
"I too will stand beside you, my lord," he cried. "Any man who would raise a hand against you must first strike down Domenico Colombo."
Cristoforo saw how the others reacted. Where they had nodded when De Portobello made his promise of loyalty, they only looked silently at the table when Father spoke. Some of them turned red in anger, embarrassment. Cristoforo wasn't sure why they would not want to hear Father's promise. Was it because only a gentleman could fight well enough to protect the rightful doge? Or was it because Father should not have been so bold as to speak at all in such exalted company? Whatever the reason, Cristoforo could see that their silence had struck Father like a blow. He seemed to wither as he shrank back against the wall. Only when his humiliation was complete did Pietro speak again.
"Our success depends on all the Fieschi fighting with courage and loyalty."
His words were gracious, but they were too late to spare Father's feelings. They came not as an honorable acceptance of Father's offer, but rather as a consolation, the way a man might pet a loyal dog. "Father doesn't matter to them," thought Cristoforo. "They meet in his house because they must keep their meeting secret, but he himself is nothing to them." The meeting ended soon after. The decision was to go on the attack in 2 days. As soon as the gentleman had left and Father closed the door, Mother sailed past Cristoforo and pushed herself into Father's face.
"What do you mean, you fool? If anyone wants to harm the rightful doge, they'll have to strike down Domenico Colombo first? What nonsense! When did you become a soldier? Where is your fine sword? How many duels have you fought? Or are you thinking this will be a brawl in a tavern, and you have only to knock together the heads of a couple of drunks and the battle will be won? Do you care nothing for our children, that you plan to leave them fatherless?"
"A man has honor," said Father. Cristoforo wondered. What is Father's honor when his greatest friend despises the offer of his life?
"Your honor will have your children on the street in rags." "My honor made me keeper of the Olivella gate for 4 years. You liked living in our fine house then, didn't you?"
"That time is over," said Mother. "Blood will flow, and it will not be Adorno blood."
"Don't be too sure of that," said Father.
He stormed upstairs. Mother burst into tears of rage and frustration. The argument was over. But Cristoforo wasn't satisfied. He waited as Mother calmed herself by pulling the extra spools away from the table and putting the cloth back on it, so customers could look at it and so it would stay clean. When he judged he could speak without being screamed at, he said,
"How do gentlemen learn to be gentlemen?"
She glared at him.
"They're born that way," she said. "God made them gentlemen."
"But why can't we learn to talk the way they do?"
Cristoforo asked.
"I don't think it would be hard."
Cristoforo imitated the refined voice of De Portobello, saying,
"You were never one who punished a man for saying what he believed to be the truth."
Mother came to him and slapped him hard across the face. It stung, and even though Cristoforo had long since stopped crying when he was punished, the sheer surprise of it more than the sting made tears leap from his eyes.
"Don't ever let me hear you putting on airs like that again, Cristoforo," she shouted. "Are you too good for your father? Do you think that honking like a goose will make you grow feathers?"
In his anger, Cristoforo shouted back at her.
"My father is as good a man as any of them. Why shouldn't his son learn to be a gentleman?"
Almost she slapped him again for having dared to answer her back. But then she caught herself and actually heard what he had said.
"Your father is as good as any of them," she said. "Better."
Cristoforo gestured toward the fine fabrics spread across the table.
"There is the cloth. Why can't father dress like a gentleman? Why can't he speak the way they do and dress like them? And then the Doge would honor him."
"The Doge would laugh at him," said Mother.
"And so would everyone else. And then if he kept on trying to act the gentleman, one of them would come along and put a rapier through your father's heart for daring to be such an upstart."
"Why would they laugh at him if they don't laugh at these other men for dressing and talking the way they do?"
"Because they really are gentlemen, and your father is not."
"But if it isn't their clothing and their language, is there something in their blood? They didn't look stronger than father. They had weak arms, and most of them were fat."
"Father is stronger than they are, of course. But they carry swords."
"Then father should buy a sword."
"Who would sell a sword to a weaver?" said Mother, laughing. "And what would father do with it? He has never wielded a sword in his life. He'd cut off his own fingers."
"Not if he practiced," said Cristoforo. "Not if he learned."
"It isn't the sword that makes a man a gentleman," said Mother. "Gentlemen are born as the children of gentlemen, that's all. Your father's father wasn't a gentleman, and so he isn't."
Cristoforo thought about this for a moment.
"Aren't we all descended from Noah after the flood? Why are the children of one family gentlemen and the children of father's family aren't? God made us all."
Mother laughed bitterly.
"Is that what the priests taught you? Well, you should see them bowing and scraping to the gentlemen while they piss on the rest of us. They think that God likes gentlemen better. But Jesus Christ didn't act that way. He cared nothing for gentlemen."
"So what gives them the right to look down at father?"
demanded Cristoforo. And against his will, his eyes again filled with tears. She regarded him for a moment, as if deciding whether to tell him the truth.
"Gold and dirt," she said.
Cristoforo didn't understand.
"They have gold in their treasure boxes," said Mother, "and they own land. That's what makes them gentlemen. If we had huge swatches of land out in the country, or if we had a box filled with gold in the attic, then your father would be a gentleman, and no one would laugh at you if you learned to talk the fancy way they do and wore clothing made of this."
She held the trailing end of a bolt of cloth against Cristoforo's chest.
"You'd make a fine gentleman, my Cristoforo."
Then she dropped the fabric and laughed and laughed and laughed. Finally, Cristoforo left the room. Gold, he thought. If father had gold, then those other men would listen to him.
Well then, I will get him gold.
One of the men at the meeting must have been a traitor, or perhaps one of them spoke carelessly, where a traitorous servant overheard. But somehow the Adornos got word of the plans of the Fieschi, and when Pietro and his two bodyguards showed up beside the cylindrical towers of the Sant'Andrea gate, where the rendezvous was supposed to take place, they were set upon by a dozen of the Adornos. Pietro was dragged from his horse and struck in the head with a mace. They left him for dead as they ran away. The shouting could be heard in the Colombo house as clearly as if it had happened next door, which it almost had. They lived scarcely 100 yards from the Sant'Andrea gate. They heard the first shouts of the men, and Pietro's voice as he cried out, "Fieschi! To me, Fieschi!" At once father took his heavy staff from its place by the fire and ran into the street. Mother got to the front of the house too late to stop him. Screaming and crying, she gathered the children and the apprentices into the back of the house while the journeyman stood guard at the front door. There, in the gathering darkness, they heard the tumult and shouting, and then Pietro's screaming. For he had not been killed outright, and now in his agony he howled for help in the night.
"Fool," whispered Mother,
If he keeps screeching like that, he'll tell all the Adornos that they didn't kill him, and they'll come back and finish him off.
Will they kill father?
Asked Cristoforo. The younger children began to cry. No, said mother, but Cristoforo could tell that she was not sure. Perhaps she could sense his skepticism. All fools, she said. All men are fools, fighting over who gets to rule Genova. What does that matter? The Turk is in Constantinople. The heathens have the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The name of Christ is no longer spoken in Egypt. And these little boys are squabbling over who gets to sit on a fancy chair and call himself the Doge of Genova. What is the honor of Pietro Fregoso compared to the honor of Jesus Christ? What is it to possess the palace of the Doge, when the land where the Blessed Virgin walked in her garden, where the angel came to her, is in the hands of circumcised dogs? If they want to kill somebody, let them liberate Jerusalem. Let them free Constantinople. Let them shed blood to redeem the honor of the Son of God.
That's what I will fight for, said Cristoforo.
Don't fight,
said one of his sisters.
They'd kill you.
I'd kill them first.
You're very small, Cristoforo, his sister said.
I won't always be small.
Hush, said mother. This is all nonsense. The son of a weaver doesn't go on crusade.
Why not? Said Cristoforo. Would Christ refuse my sword?
What sword? Said mother scornfully.
I'll have a sword one day, said Cristoforo. I'll be a gentleman. How, when you have no gold?
I'll get gold.
In Genova? As a weaver? As long as you live, you'll be the son of Domenico Colombo. No one will give you gold, and no one will call you a gentleman. Now be silent, or I'll pinch your arm.
It was a worthy threat, and all the children knew well enough to obey when mother uttered it. A couple of hours later, father came home. The journeyman almost didn't let him in, just from his knocking. Not until he cried out in anguish, "My lord is dead, let me in," did they unbar the door. He staggered inside just as the children raced after mother into the front room. Father was covered with blood, and mother screamed and embraced him and then searched him for wounds. "It's not my blood," he said in anguish. "It's the blood of my doge. Pietro Fregoso is dead. The cowards set on him and pulled him from his horse and struck him in the head with a mace."
"Why are you covered with his blood, Nico?"
"I carried him to the doors of the palace of the Doge. I carried him to the place where he ought to be."
"Why would you do that, you fool?"
"Because he told me to. I came to him and he was crying out and covered with blood, and I said, 'Let me take you to your physicians, let me take you to your house, let me find the ones who did this and kill them for you.' And he said to me, 'Domenico, take me to the palace. That's where the Doge should die, in the palace like my father.' So I carried him there in my own arms, and I didn't care if the Adorno saw us. I carried him there, and he was in my arms when he died. I was his true friend."
"If they saw you with him, they'll find you and kill you."
"What does it matter?" said father. "The Doge is dead."
"It matters to me," said mother. "Get those clothes off." She turned to the journeyman and began giving orders. "You, get the children to the back of the house. You, have the apprentices draw water and heat it for a bath. You, when I get these clothes off him, burn them." The other children obeyed the journeyman and fled to the back of the house, but Cristoforo did not. He watched as his mother undressed his father, covering him with kisses and curses the whole time. Even after she led him into the courtyard for his bath, even as the stench of the burning, bloody clothing came into the house, Cristoforo stayed there in the front room. He was on watch, guarding the door.
Or so the old accounts of that night all said. Columbus was on watch to keep his family safe. But Dico knew that this was not all that was going through Cristoforo's mind. No. He was making his decision. He was setting before himself the terms of his future greatness. He would be a gentleman. Kings and queens would treat him with respect. He would have gold. He would conquer kingdoms in the name of Christ. He must have known even then that to accomplish all of this, he would have to leave Genova. As his mother had said, as long as he lived in this city, he would be the son of Domenico, the weaver. From the next morning, he bent his life toward achieving his new goals. He began to study languages, history, with such vigor that the monks who were teaching him commented on it. He has caught the spirit of scholarship, they said. But Dico knew that it wasn't learning for its own sake. He had to know languages to travel abroad in the world. He had to know history to know what was in the world when he ventured into it. And he had to know how to sail. Every chance he got, Cristoforo was down at the docks, listening to the sailors, questioning them, learning what all the crewmen did. Later, he focused on the navigators, plying them with wine when he could afford it, simply demanding answers when he could not. Eventually, it would get him aboard a ship, and then another. He turned down no chance to sail, and did any work that was asked of him, so that he would know all that a weaver's son could hope to learn about the sea. Dico made her report on Cristoforo Colombo on the moment when he made his decision. As always, her father praised it, criticizing only minor points. But she knew by now that his praise could conceal serious criticism. When she challenged him, he wouldn't tell her what his criticism was. "I say that this report is a good one," he told her. "Now leave me alone." "There's something wrong with it," Dico said, "and you're not telling me." "It's a well-written report. It has nothing wrong except the points I told you."
"Then you disagree with my conclusion. You don't think this was what made Cristoforo decide to be great?"
"Decide to be great?" asked Father. "Yes, I think this is almost certainly the point in his life when he made that decision."
"Then what's wrong with it?" she shouted.
"Nothing," he shouted back.
"I'm not a child."
He looked at her in consternation.
"You aren't?"
"You're humoring me, and I'm tired of it." "All right," he said. "Your report is excellent and observant. He certainly decided on the night you pinpointed and for the reasons that you laid out that he would pursue gold and greatness and the glory of God. All that is very good. But there is not one breath of a hint in anything you reported on that would tell us why and how he decided that he would achieve those goals by sailing west into the Atlantic." It struck as brutally as the slap that Cristoforo's mother had given him, and it brought the same tears to her eyes, even though there was no physical blow involved.
"I'm sorry," said Father. "You said you were not a child."
"I'm not," she said. "And you're wrong."
"I am."
"My project is to find when the decision for greatness was made, and that's what I found. It's your project and Mother's project to figure out when Columbus decided to go west." Father looked at her in surprise.
"Well, yes, I suppose so. It's certainly something we need to know."
"So there's nothing wrong with my report for my project, just because it doesn't happen to answer the question that's bothering you and yours?"
"You're right," said Father.
"I know."
"Well, now I know, too. I withdraw the criticism. Your report is complete and acceptable, and I accept it.
Congratulations."
But she didn't go away.
"Dico, I'm working," he said.
"I'll find it for you," she said.
"Find what?"
"Whatever it was that caused Cristoforo to sail west."
"Finish your own project, Dico," said Father.
"You don't think I can, do you?"
"I've been over the recordings of Columbus's life, and so has your mother, and so have countless other scholars and scientists. You think you'll find what none of them ever found?"
"Yes," said Dico.
"Well," said Father, "I think we've just isolated your decision for greatness."
He smiled at her, a crooked little smile. She assumed that he was teasing her, but she didn't care. He might think he was joking, but she would make his joke turn real. Had he and Mother and countless others pored over all the old TempoView recordings of Columbus's life? Very well, then. Dico would stop looking at recordings at all. She would go and look directly at his life, and not with the TempoView either. The true sight, too, would be her tool. She didn't ask for permission, and she didn't ask for help.
She simply took over a machine that wasn't used at night and adjusted the schedule of her life to fit the hours when the machine was hers to use. Some wondered whether she really ought to be using the most up-to-date machines. After all, she wasn't actually a member of Pastwatch. Her training was at best informal. She was merely the child of Watchers, and yet she was using a machine that one normally got access to after years of study. Those who had those doubts, however, seeing the set of her face, seeing how hard she worked and how quickly she learned to use the machine, soon lost any desire to question her right to do it. It occurred to some of them that this was the human way, after all. You went to school to learn to do a trade that was different from your parents' work. But if you were going into the family business, you learned it from childhood up. Deco was as much a watcher as anyone else, and by all indications, a good one. And those who had at first thought of questioning her, or even stopping her, instead notified the authorities that here was a novice worth observing. A recording was started, watching all that Deco did, and soon she had a silver tag on her file. Let this one go where she wants.
Chapter 4. Kamal. The Santa Maria sank on a reef on the north shore of Hispaniola due to Columbus's foolhardiness in sailing at night and the inattention of the pilot. But the Niña and the Pinta did not sink. They sailed home to report to Europe on the vast lands awaiting them to the west, triggering a westward flood of immigrants, conquerors, and explorers that wouldn't stop for 500 years. If Columbus was to be stopped, the Niña and the Pinta could not return to Spain. The man who sank them was Kamal Akiazi, and the path that brought him to Tagiri's project to change history was a long and strange one. Kamal Akiazi grew up within a few miles of the ruins of Troy. From his boyhood home above Kumkali, he could see the waters of the Dardanelles, the narrow strait that connects the waters of the Black Sea with the Aegean. Many a war had been fought on both sides of that strait, one of which had produced the great epic of Homer's Iliad. This pressure of history had a strange influence on Kamal as a child. He learned all the tales of the place, of course, but he also knew that the tales were Greek, and the place was of the Greek-Aegean world. Kamal was a Turk. His own ancestors had not come to the Dardanelles until the 15th century. He felt that it was a powerful place, but it did not belong to him. So the Iliad was not the story that spoke to Kamal's soul. Rather, it was the story of Heinrich Schliemann, the German explorer, who, in an era when Troy had been regarded as a mere legend, a myth, a fiction, had been sure not only that Troy was real, but also that he could find it. Despite all scoffers, he mounted an expedition and located it and unburied it. The old stories turned out to be true. In his teens, Kamal thought it was the greatest tragedy of his life that Pastwatch was using machines to look through the millennia of human history. There would be no more Schliemanns, studying and pondering and guessing until they found some artifact, some ruin of a long-lost city, some remnant of a legend made true again. Thus, Kamal had no interest in joining Pastwatch, though they tried to recruit him for it as he entered college. It was not history, but exploration and discovery that he hungered for. What was the glory in finding the truth through a machine? So, after an abortive try at physics, he studied to become a meteorologist. At the age of 18, heavily immersed in the study of climate and weather, he touched again on the findings of Pastwatch. No longer did meteorologists have to depend on only a few centuries of weather measurements and fragmentary fossil evidence to determine long-range patterns. Now they had accurate accounts of storm patterns for millions of years. Indeed, in the earliest years of Pastwatch, the machinery of the TrueSight 1 had been so coarse that individual humans could not be seen. It was like time-lapse photography, in which people don't remain in place long enough to be on more than a single frame of the film, making them invisible. So in those days, Pastwatch recorded the weather of the past, erosion patterns, volcanic eruptions, ice ages, climatic shifts. All that data was the bedrock on which modern weather prediction and control rested. Meteorologists could see developing patterns, and without disrupting the overall pattern, could make tiny changes that prevented any one area from going completely rainless during a time of drought, or sunless during a wet growing season. They had taken the sharp edge off the relentless scythe of climate, and now the great project was to determine how they might make a more serious change, to bring a steady pattern of light rain to the desert regions of the world, to restore the prairies and savannas that had once been there. That was the work that Kamal wanted to be a part of. Yet he could not bring himself out from the shadow of Troy, the memory of Schliemann. Even as he studied the climatic shifts involved with the waxing and waning of the ice ages, his mind contained fleeting images of lost civilizations, legendary places that waited for a Schliemann to uncover them. His project for his degree in meteorology was part of the effort to determine how the Red Sea might be exploited to develop dependable rains for the Sudan and Central Arabia. Kamal's immediate target was to study the difference between weather patterns during the last ice age, when the Red Sea had all but disappeared, and the present, with the Red Sea at its fullest. Back and forth he went through the coarse old Pastwatch recordings, gathering data on sea level and on precipitation at selected points inland. The old TrueSight 1 had been imprecise at best, but good enough for counting rainstorms. Time after time, Kamal would cycle through the up-and-down fluctuations of the Red Sea, watching as the average sea level gradually rose toward the end of the Ice Age. He always stopped, of course, at the abrupt jump in sea level that marked the rejoining of the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. After that, the Red Sea was useless for his purposes, since its sea level was tied to that of the Great World Ocean. The echo of Schliemann inside Kamal's mind made him think, what a flood that must have been. What a flood. The Ice Age had locked up so much water in glaciers and ice sheets that the sea level of the whole world fell. It eventually reached a low enough point that land bridges arose out of the sea. In the North Pacific, the Bering Land Bridge allowed the ancestors of the Indies to cross on foot into their great empty homeland. Britain and Flanders were joined. The Dardanelles were closed and the Black Sea became a salty lake. The Persian Gulf disappeared and became a great plain cut by the Euphrates. And the Bab al-Mandab, the strait at the mouth of the Red Sea, became a land bridge. But a land bridge is also a dam. As the world climate warmed and the glaciers began to release their pent-up water, the rains fell heavily everywhere. Rivers swelled and the seas rose. The great south-flowing rivers of Europe, which had been mostly dry during the peak of glaciation, now were massive torrents. The Rhone, the Po, the Strymon, the Danube poured so much water into the Mediterranean and the Black Sea that their water level rose at about the same rate as that of the great world ocean. The Red Sea had no great rivers, however. It was, in geological terms, a new sea, formed by rifting between the new Arabian plate and the ancient African, which meant it had uplift ridges on both coasts. Many rivers and streams flowed from those ridges down into the Red Sea, but none of them carried much water compared to the rivers that drained vast basins and carried the melt-off of the glaciers of the north. So while the Red Sea gradually rose during this time, it lagged far, far behind the great world ocean. Its water level responded to the immediate local weather patterns rather than to worldwide weather. Until one day, the Indian Ocean rose so high that tides began to spill over the Bab al-Mandab. The water cut new channels in the grassland there. Over a period of several years, the leakage grew, creating a series of large new tidal lakes on the Hainish Plain. And then, one day, some 14,000 years ago, the flow cut a channel so deep that it didn't dry up at low tide. The water kept running through it, cutting the channel deeper and deeper, until those tidal lakes were full and brimmed over. With the weight of the Indian Ocean behind it, the water gushed into the basin of the Red Sea in a vast flood that in a few hours brought the Red Sea up to the level of the world ocean. This isn't just the boundary marker between useful and useless water level data, thought Kamal. This is a cataclysm, one of the rare times when a single event changes a vast area in a period of time short enough that human beings could notice it. And for once, this cataclysm happened in an era when human beings were there. It was not only possible, but likely that someone saw this flood. Indeed, that it killed many. For the southern end of the Red Sea basin was rich savanna and marshland up to the moment when the ocean broke through, and surely the humans of 14,000 years ago would have hunted there, would have gathered seeds and fruits and berries there. Some hunting party must have seen, from the peaks of the Dehalak Mountains, the great walls of water that roared up the plain, breaking and parting around the slopes of the Dehaliks, making islands of them. Such a hunting party would have known that their families had been killed by this water. What would they have thought? Surely that some god was angry with them, that the world had been done away, buried under the sea. And if they survived, if they found a way to the Eritrean shore after the great turbulent waves settled down to the more placid waters of the new, deeper sea, they would tell the tale to anyone who would listen. And for a few years they could take their hearers to the water's edge, show them the treetops barely rising above the surface of the sea, and tell them tales of all that had been buried under the waves. Noah, thought Kamal. The immortal Utnapishtim, the flood survivor that Gilgamesh visited. Zeusudra of the Sumerian flood story. Atlantis. The stories were believed. The stories were remembered. In time, the tellers of the tale forgot where it happened. They naturally transposed the events to locations that they knew. But they remembered the things that mattered. What did the flood story of Noah say? Not just rain. No, it wasn't a flood caused by rain alone. The fountains of the great deep broke open. No local flood on the Mesopotamian plain would cause that image to be part of the story. But the great wall of water from the Indian Ocean, coming on the heels of years of steadily increasing rain, that would bring those words to the storyteller's lips, generation after generation, for 10,000 years, until they could be written down. As for Atlantis, everyone was so sure they had found it years ago. Santorini, Theos, the Aegean island that blew up. But the older stories of Atlantis said nothing of blowing up in a volcano. They spoke only of the great civilization sinking into the sea. The supposition was that later visitors came to Santorini, and seeing water where an island city used to be, assumed that it had sunk, knowing nothing of the volcanic eruption. To Kamal, however, this now seemed far-fetched indeed, compared to the way it would have looked to the people of Atlantis themselves, somewhere on the Massawa plain, when the Red Sea seemed to leap up in its bed, engulfing the city. That would be sinking into the sea. No explosion, just water. And if the city were in the marshes of what was now the Massawa Channel, the water would have come not just from the southeast, but from the northeast and the north as well, flowing among and around the Dahalak Mountains, making islands of them and swallowing up the marshes and the city with them. Atlantis. They were not beyond the Pillars of Hercules, but Plato was right to associate the city with a strait. He, or whoever told the tale to him, simply replaced the Bab al-Mandab with the greatest strait that he had heard of. The story might well have reached Plato by way of Phoenicia, where Mediterranean sailors would have made the story fit the sea they knew. They learned it from Egyptians, perhaps, or nomad wanderers from the hinterlands of Arabia, or perhaps it was already latent within every old world culture by then, and within the Straits of Mandab would have become within the Pillars of Hercules. And then, because the Mediterranean itself was not strange and exotic enough, the locale was moved outside even that strait. All these suppositions came to Kamal with the absolute certainty that they were true, or nearly true. He rejoiced at the thought of it. There was still an ancient civilization left to discover. But if it was there, why hadn't Past Watch found it? The answer was simple enough. The past was huge, and while the TrueSight 1 had been used to collect climatological information, the new machines that were precise enough to track individual human beings would never have been used to look at oceans where nobody lived. Yes, the Tempo View had explored the Bering Strait and the English Channel, but that was to track long-known-of migrations. There was no such migration in the Red Sea. Past Watch had simply never looked through their precise new machines to see what was under the water of the Red Sea in the waning centuries of the last ice age. And they never would look either, unless someone gave them a compelling reason. Kemal understood bureaucracy enough to know that he, a student meteorologist, would hardly be taken seriously if he brought an Atlantis theory to Past Watch, particularly a theory that put Atlantis in the Red Sea, of all places, and 14,000 years ago, long before civilizations arose in Sumeria or Egypt, let alone China or the Indus Valley, or among the swamps at Tehuantepec. Yet Kemal also knew that the setting would have been right for a civilization to grow in the marshy land of the Massawa Channel. Though there weren't enough rivers flowing into the Red Sea to fill it at the same rate as the world ocean, there were still rivers. For instance, the Zula, which still had enough water to flow even today, once watered the whole length of the Massawa Plain, and flowed down into the rump of the Red Sea near Mursa Mubarak. And because of the different rainfall patterns of that time, there was a large and dependable river flowing out of the Asahara Basin. Asahara was now a dry rift valley below sea level, but then it would have been a freshwater lake fed by many streams and spilling over the lowest point into the Massawa Channel. The river meandered along the nearly level Massawa Plain, with some branches of it joining the Zula River, and some wandering east and north to form several mouths in the Red Sea. Thus, dependable sources of fresh water fed the area, and in rainy season the Zula, at least, would have brought new silt to freshen the soil, and in all seasons the wandering flatwater rivers would have provided a means of transportation through the marshes. The climate was also dependably warm, with plenty of sunlight and a long growing season. There was no early civilization that did not grow up in such a setting. There was no reason a civilization might not have grown up then. Yes, it was 6,000 or 7,000 years too early, but couldn't it be that the very destruction of Atlantis convinced the survivors that the gods did not want human beings to gather together in cities? Weren't there hints of that anti-civilization bias lingering in many of the ancient religions of the Middle East? What was the story of Cain and Abel, if not a metaphorical expression of the evil of the city-dweller, the farmer, the brother-killer, who is judged unworthy by the gods because he does not wander with his sheep? Couldn't such stories have circulated widely in those ancient times? That would explain why the survivors of Atlantis hadn't immediately begun to rebuild their civilization at another site. They knew that the gods forbade it, that if they built again, their city would be destroyed again. So they remembered the stories of their glorious past, and at the same time condemned their ancestors and warned everyone they met against people gathering together to build a city. It would have made people yearn for such a place and fear it, both at once. Not until a Nimrod came, a tower builder, a Babel maker who defied the old religion, would the ancient prescription be overcome at last, and another city rise up in another river valley far in time and space from Atlantis, but remembering the old ways that have been memorialized in the stories and, as far as possible, replicating them. We will build a tower so high that it can't be immersed. Didn't Genesis link the flood with Babel in just that way, complete with the nomad's stern disapproval of the city? This was the story that survived in Mesopotamia, the tale of the beginning of city life there, but with clear memories of a more ancient civilization that had been destroyed in a flood. A more ancient civilization, the Golden Age, the giants who once walked the earth. Why couldn't all these stories be remembering the first human civilization, the place where the city was invented, Atlantis, the city of the Massawa Plain? But how could he prove it without using the Tempo View? And how could he get access to one of those machines without first convincing Pastwatch that Atlantis was really in the Red Sea? It was circular, with no way out. Until he thought, why do large cities form in the first place? Because there are public works to do that require more than a few people to accomplish them. Kamal wasn't sure what form the public works might take, but surely they would have made something that would change the face of the land plainly enough that the old TrueSight 1 recordings would show it, though it wouldn't be noticeable unless someone was looking for it. So, putting his degree at risk, Kamal set aside the work he'd been assigned to do and began poring over the old TrueSight 1 recordings. He concentrated on the last century before the Red Sea Flood. There was no reason to suppose that the civilization had lasted very long before it was destroyed, and within a few months he had collected data that was irrefutable. There were no dikes and dams to prevent flooding. That kind of structure would have been large enough that no one would have missed it on the first go-round. Instead, there were seemingly random heaps of mud and earth that grew between rainy seasons, especially in the drier years when the rivers were lower than usual. To people looking only for weather patterns, these unstructured, random piles would mean nothing. But to Kamal, they were obvious. In the shallowing water, the Atlanteans were dredging channels so that their boats could continue to traffic from place to place. The piles of earth were simply the dumping places for the muck they dredged from the water. None of the boats showed up on the TrueSight 1, but now that Kamal knew where to look, he began to catch fleeting glimpses of reed huts. Every year when the floods came, the houses disappeared, so they were only visible for a moment or two in the TrueSight 1. Flimsy, mud and reed structures that must have been swept away in every flood season and rebuilt again when the waters receded. But they were there, close by the hillocks that marked the channels. Plato was right again. Atlantis grew up around its canals. But Atlantis was the people and their boats. The buildings were washed away and built again every year. When Kamal presented his findings to Pastwatch, he was not yet 20 years old, but his evidence was impressive enough that Pastwatch immediately turned, not a tempo view, but the still newer TrueSight 2 machine, to look under the waters of the Red Sea in the Massava Channel during the 100 years before the Red Sea Flood. They found that Kamal was gloriously, spectacularly right. In an era when other humans were still following game animals and gathering berries, the Atlanteans were planting amaranth and ryegrass, melons and beans in the rich, wet silt of the receding rivers, and carrying food in baskets and on reed boats from place to place. The only thing that Kamal had missed was that most of the buildings weren't houses at all. They were floating silos for the storage of grain. The Atlanteans slept under the open air during the dry season, and in the rainy season they lived on their tiny reed boats. Kamal was brought into Pastwatch and made head of the vast new Atlantis project. At first he loved the work, because, like Schliemann, he could search for the originals of the great events. Most important to Kamal was when he found Noah, though he had a different name, Yevazveda when he was a child, Naog when he became an adult. For his trial of manhood, this Yevazveda, already tall for his age, made the perilous journey to the land bridge at the Bab al-Mandab to see the heaving sea. He saw it all right, but also saw that this arm of the Indian Ocean was only a few meters below the level of the bench that marked the old shoreline of the Red Sea before the last ice age. Yevazveda knew nothing of ice ages, but he knew that the shelf of land was absolutely level. He had loped along that route during his entire journey. Yet that level shelf was hundreds of meters above the plain where the salty sea, the rump of the Red Sea, was slowly, slowly rising. Already the heaving sea was cutting a channel that during the storm tides of seasonal hurricanes poured salt water into several lakes, occasionally spilling over and sending a river of salt water down to the Red Sea. Sometime, the next storm, or the storm after that, the heaving sea would crash through, and an entire ocean would be poured in on top of Atlantis. Yevazveda decided that he had earned his man name, Naog, the day he made this discovery, and at once he set out for home. He had married a wife from among the tribe that lived at the Bab al-Mandab, and it was only with great difficulty that she followed him so far that he was given no choice but to bring her home with him. When he reached the land of the Durku, as the Atlanteans called themselves, he learned that what had seemed plain to him at the shores of the heaving sea sounded